run a site called selfadoration.com. I wrote a book called Man Alive, a Survival Manual. Howdy. Greg Swan here. I run a site called selfadoration.com. I wrote a book called Man Alive, a Survival Manual for the Human Mind. And I am playing with Spreecast.com to decide if I want to turn this into some kind of broadcasting phenomenon. I like the idea, frankly, because I like the whole idea of radio, talk radio. I like the intimacy of radio. I like the intimacy of this kind of video. I've been doing this for a few weeks, 7 weeks, 8 weeks, on selfadoration.com, and I really enjoy it. I can do what I'm doing right now. I can stare right at you. Right, Ophelia. I have a coon hand who joined me slightly off camera. I don't know why she's sniffing around, but she's here with me. I am playing my guitar because I like to do it. And making excellent noise with it. If it occurs to you to tell me that I'm not all that good at playing the guitar, I will agree with you. I'm not good, but I like to do it. And it calms me down. It slows me down. I am a very fast talker. I tend to be a very fast thinker. And if you just let me run wild, I am apt to run away with things. And so playing the guitar slows me down and enables me to collect my thoughts in such a way that I can enunciate them in a relatively sane and normal fashion. I have no idea if anyone is going to join me today, and that's obviously the whole idea here is to have people join me so that I can talk to them. That's one of the benefits of the Spreecast software, and I find it amazing. I really think it's incredible software, and so I'm eager to really put it to the test, but whether or not anyone joins me, I am completely capable of carrying on indefinitely all on my own. I've been talking for weeks now, but lately quite a bit more about the issue of free will and determinism. And if you're not familiar with Man Alive, I will clue you in. It is a book of philosophy. It's a book of hard-headed, common-sense, practical philosophy for normal people. And I don't have any tremendous respect for academic philosophy or for academia in general, for the most part, because I think most academics are foot soldiers of tyranny. They are the intellectual arsenal of Marxism primarily, but of tyranny in general. The greatest peril to human existence obviously has been Marxism. It killed 160 million people in the 20th century. These are innocent people who were just slaughtered by a political philosophy. There are mountainous grave sites all through Eastern Europe and Southeast Asia. And we are, it's common to cite the atrocities committed by the Nazis, who are the National Socialists, a different brand of Marxists. So we take note of the 17 million people killed by the Nazis, and we should. This is a condemnable practice. But we don't condemn the millions more people murdered by the Red Communists, the Soviets and the Chinese Communists and the Khmer Rouge and all of the other flavors of communism that have infested the earth. And most of academia is Marxist. Most academics are Marxist in one way or another. If they're not outright communist, then they are cowardly communists. They're unwilling to criticize Marxist orthodoxy. And in consequence, most of what gets produced by the academy, by the universities, is in one way or another Marxist propaganda. And certainly this argument about determinism and free will is, it plays right into the hands of the Marxists, that whatever reasons any particular scientist or professor or philosopher or theologian might have for disputing the existence of free will, ultimately the benefit accrues to the communists. It accrues to people who want the state to grow larger. And, you know, if I'm criticizing communists, then people are going to automatically assume that I'm some kind of Republican or something like that, and I am not. I promise you I am not. I refer to the practices of the Republican Party and much of the Democratic Party in the United States as Rotarian socialism. It's not outright Marxism. It's Marxism light, Marxism on the cheap, and it exists to provide unearned profits for criminals. We call it crony capitalism. I think that's Sarah Palin's term, or that's the term that you'll often hear if you read on the internet. I call it Rotarian socialism, but it all really, what it really boils down to is marshaling the forces of the state to push innocent people around and take their money and their property and their time and their labor and give it to someone who hasn't earned it. And obviously, being slaughtered and thrown onto a mountainous pile of bodies and covered with lime and dirt is a horrible, horrible fate. That's a worse fate than having your pocket picked, but there is no justification for crime in any form, and I am 100% anti-crime. I am, politically, I am a libertarian. I'm actually an anarcho-capitalist. We'll come back to anarcho-capitalism someday, not today, but, anyone who says, oh, I don't dare listen to an anarchist is really has to have his head examined, because whatever my political views might happen to be, there is no threat that they will be implemented tomorrow. And so you are completely safe to listen to me, because there's nothing that I'm talking about or nothing that I ever will talk about that is eminently likely to be implemented. You're completely safe from me. But politically, I'm an anarcho-capitalist, which is a brand of libertarianism. Libertarianism is a form of the politics of individualism, but individualism is the politics of egoism. And what I am most fundamentally is an egoist. I am an advocate of an idea that I call self-adoration, which means the identification of the self, your own self, appropriately, accurately identifying it, and then honoring it in every possible way, in every choice that you make, choosing to make your choices in such a way that you will find your actions admirable when you take them, and you will find your past actions admirable going forward, that you will admire, revere, and ultimately worship yourself. And by worship, I mean worship like a god, and we're going to come back to God. Come back to everything eventually. I think about everything, and I like to think about everything, and I like to explore ideas in enormous detail. But the issue of determinism is interesting to me, not as a matter of science or psychology or anything at all like that. It's interesting to me as a matter of ethics, as a matter of teleology. Teleology is the branch of philosophy concerned with oughts, concerned with ends, concerned with what you should do. And the determinist argument, to my mind, is a remarkable failure, because it provides no guidance, no useful guidance about what you should do, what your behavior should be. To the contrary, to accept it and to actually attempt to act upon it leads to fatalism, the belief that everything is fated and nothing can be changed and there's no benefit to me acting in my own behalf, whatever, because nothing can be changed. And that's ridiculous. It's obviously untrue. It is obviously untrue. And therefore, the whole theory is suspect, not just suspect, I think it's bogus, but the mere fact that I can, when I'm coming up on the street corner, I can look left, I can look right, I can look left again and make sure that I'm not going to get hit by a car before I step out into the street. The fact that I can do that, I think, is proof positive that the determinist argument is in error, that it is fallacious, that it is bogus, because I can act in my own behalf. And that's an extremely simple example, but anything that you might want to talk about, including me strumming away at this guitar while I talk, all of these things are predicated upon my making free, conceptually conscious choices, and none of those choices are fated, are foreordained, are unavoidable. And no choice that any human being can make is unavoidable. And in consequence, I mean, two things fall out from that. Number one, if you're unhappy with your circumstances, change them. And number two, the fact that you can change your circumstances tells you that that determinism as a teleology is completely useless. It's useless. And I don't dispute that there may be circumstances where someone might want to entertain that idea. I don't know why they would, but if they want to, they can. But they are simply screwing around in a formal system. They are not talking about ontology. Ontology is the branch of philosophy concerned with true existence, with the existence of things the way that they really are, as opposed to the way that we might imagine them or hypothesize them or whatever. That when something is ontologically true, it is true of the object, of the circumstance, of reality as it actually exists, regardless of what you think about it. And I uphold the idea of the prior existence of reality, which simply means that the universe exists prior to your consciousness of it and irrespective of your consciousness, and it will continue to exist after you no longer are conscious of it. And, you know, in philosophy there are all kinds of retarded theories for getting around the prior existence of reality, for instance, solipsism, the universe is a creation of my imagination. But all of these things are, again, this is teleologically useless. It is useless in the management of your own life. The universe is a creation of my imagination, and therefore when I go to cross the street, I won't look left, I won't look right, I won't look left again. No, that's absurd. Number one, if you actually guided your behavior on the basis of that teleology, you would perish. You would be wiped out in very short order. I mean, you might make it across the street one time, two times, three times, five times. Five times is 32 to 1 against. The odds are 32 to 1 against. Six times, 64 to 1 against. Seven times, 128 to 1 against. How many times are you going to have to cross the street blindfolded without looking before you're going to get smacked by a car? I mean, if you're going to make it eight times, 256 to 255 to 1 against, I don't think so. It's not going to happen. And the fact of the matter is you're not going to do that. You will not do that when you come to the street corner, if it's a busy street corner, and if you take yourself out into the country where there was never any traffic in order to defy the odds. Well, three cheers for you. You're a championship asshole, in my opinion. But if you are crossing busy streets without looking both ways before you cross, you will perish, and so of course you won't do that. No matter what idiot claims you make about ontology, no matter what absurd claims you make about teleology, when you actually come to the street corner, you're going to look left, you're going to look right, you're going to look left again before you step out on the curb. And it's not because you habituated that behavior when you were young, your parents taught you to do it that way. It's because that's what you have to do in order to cross the street safely. And even then, you won't always be correct. Sometimes you're going to really have to hustle because you will have misjudged how fast a car is approaching you. But you will take account of reality before you make a choice. And this is a very simple choice, but every choice that you make, you will take account of reality before you make that choice. Because if you don't, your existence is conditional. Your existence is not foreordained. It is not fated. We are each of us doomed to die someday. That's understood. No living organism lives forever. But we all do what we can to delay that eventuality. And in so doing, we acknowledge our actual beliefs about reality. We act according to an understanding of reality that is, number one, in fact true, is ontologically consonant. And number two, by acting that way, we are conceding the prior existence of reality, our acceptance of the prior existence of reality, our acknowledgement of the consequences of defying reality, our belief in free will. All of these things are true, and the arguments that people make to the contrary are completely absurd. They're simply absurd. They are useless arguments. And the challenge at that point will be, okay, so determinism is defended in Newtonian physics by the idea that the universe is a watchword, that the moon orbits the Earth orbits the sun spins in orbit around the Milky Way. The Milky Way, all of it, orbits around a giant black hole at the middle of it all. All of this is a giant watchwork in the cosmos. And, you know, all of the galaxies are spinning in various ways, and all of it's spinning around something in the middle, and who knows what, you know. All this stuff is a giant watchwork. And the motion of celestial objects is predictable. if you know the orbit, you know the velocity, you know the craft that might be in the way, you know the things that are going to provide perturbations for the, those orbits, like the solar wind, then you can predict exactly what those things are going to do. And that predictability is what led to this Newtonian argument of determinism, that because every physical manifestation, every physical event has a prior cause, and each prior cause has its own prior cause, etc., going back to the Big Bang, to the birth of the universe, then the argument goes that every physical event that could ever possibly happen must necessarily have been foreordained by the Big Bang, that it must have been baked in the cake from the very beginning. And that argument is very plausible as long as you were talking about inanimate matter, that the sands on the beach will seem to you to be distributed in an arbitrary or random fashion, but a physicist could argue precisely where each grain of sand is where it had to be based on the prior causes acting upon it. And the same thing that we say we want a random event, so let's flip a coin. You flip a coin, it comes up heads or tails, that if you do that an infinite number of times, the distribution is going to be 50-50. That luck runs in streaks, so you could flip a coin 10 times and get heads 10 times in a row. And 10 to the second is an enormously unlikely event, and yet it still can happen. But if you do it 10 million times, the distribution is going to be 50-50. And that's why we regard this as being random. And in fact, in physical terms, it's not random at all. If you were to go up into the International Space Station and use a steel coin instead of a nickel coin, or nickel or copper or whatever, and you had a magnet at the other side of the room, and you took that coin and you held it, like my guitar pick here, you held it vertically in space, and you held it so still that when you let go, it would just float there in space, which is possible at zero gravity. This is doable. And so now you've got your fair coin, your supposed fair coin, floating in midair, in zero gravity, on the space station, and now you gently push it toward the magnet, and now it's slowly moving toward the magnet, and maybe its transit is less than 1 mile per hour, a very slow transit. And so you move along with it, and then you very gently put a spin on it. So it's not just floating through space, it's spinning. And now we have a fair coin. This is exactly the same thing as flipping a coin into the air and waiting for it to come down to see if it comes down heads or tails. Well, it's moving so slowly, and the spin is so slowly, that if you set up this experiment properly, you should be able to predict the performance of that coin every time. You should be able to tell, but at the time that you put that spin on it, you should be able to tell at that point whether it's going to come up heads or tails. And in fact, now on Earth, given what we have in the way of computing hardware, there are cameras that will take slow motion photography at 1,000 frames per second. Plausibly, you could create computing hardware that could predict the performance of a fair coin in our gravitational field, in our one, we call it one gravity, Earth gravity. Presumably, you could predict the behavior of that coin. And this is the kind of thing that people who uphold this idea of Newtonian physics are going to regard as being incredibly dispositive, that this is going to be tremendously potent proof of their theory. And I don't dispute it with respect to inanimate objects. I can argue that I can influence events in such a way that the Newtonian prediction wouldn't come true. So, for instance, if we wanted to, we could go to the moon with a bunch of nuclear weapons and set off those nuclear weapons all in one place, one after another, to the point that we are essentially moving the moon. And we could move the moon and throw it at Jupiter and crash it into Jupiter and create an amazingly big mess. Then this would be a Newtonian event in the sense that it would be kinetic, it would be physical, but it's definitely obviously not baked in the cake from the origin of the universe. And what is the reason for that? The reason is human volition, because we chose to do it. We could go out to one of the moons of Saturn and, you know, using high-powered drills, a nuclear weapon, we could split open a moon like a cantaloupe. And this is one of the, we will do this stuff. I mean, we probably won't do it with moons. We'll probably do it with asteroids, because we have the asteroid belt out there between Mars and Jupiter. We have all of these, an exploded planet that exists in beautifully sized pieces for exploitation, for instance, for mining or for turning into interstellar starships or things like that. And we will do this stuff. And to insist that that was baked in the cake from the origin of the universe is simply absurd, as is everything else associated with living organisms. The fact is that Newtonian physics cannot explain why organisms exist, nor can I, nor can anyone else. And it doesn't really matter that we can't explain it, because I have news for you. We have a tremendous amount of knowledge compared to what we knew 100 years ago or 500 years ago, and definitely amazing amounts of knowledge compared to what we knew 5,000 years ago. And everything that we know, we have learned within the last 50,000 years, obviously, because we weren't capable of learning anything before then. But everything that we know is really inconsequential compared to what we can know. And this is from quantum mechanics all the way up to astrophysics, from understanding volition as a cause, understanding will as a cause, understanding why organisms behave the way they do, why organisms exist in the first place. Organisms defy the law of entropy. And this is, I mean, this is a complete violation of the laws of physics from the Newtonian point of view. There's no, entropy says that, that matter decays, that matter goes from a more highly organized state to a less highly organized state, to a disorganized state, that matter decays, ashes to ashes, dust to dust, it says in the Bible. And that is the way everything works except for organisms. Obviously, in the long run, organisms decay too, because they die, they perish, and then the laws of Newtonian physics kick in with a vengeance, and we rot, and we dry up, and we blow away as dust. But while organisms are alive, they are defying the law of entropy, and no one knows why this happens. No one knows why this is so. And even if we knew why it was so, we still wouldn't explain free will. It would not explain how it is that I'm able to, I'm 20, almost 22 minutes I've been speaking now, extempore, no notes, whatever, how I'm able to do this, how I'm able to generate this stream of ideas. This can't be explained in Newtonian physics, and it doesn't really matter that it can't be explained, because the fact of the matter is it obviously does exist. It obviously is true, and you know it's true, and everything that you do in your own choices is proof that you know it's true, and everything that you do with respect to other people, with respect to other organisms, with respect to everything, everything that you do is predicated on your own belief that you can influence your own behavior, that you can influence other people's behavior, and that within certain limits you can influence the behavior of organisms. That nobody who has a puppy doesn't house train the puppy. I guess some people do because they keep their dogs outdoors, which is brutal. But if you have an inside dog, I promise you, you will have potty trained that dog. You will have yard trained that dog. Train the dog to pee and poop outdoors. And why did you do that? Because you yourself don't want to live in animal waste, and because you can, because the animal can be trained to do this. And the sands on the beach can't be trained in any way at all. I mean, you can go get a rake and move them around. You can get a bulldozer and scrape them away entirely. But you can't train them to do anything. You can't cause a grain of sand to do anything except sit around. And yet organisms you definitely can influence, and the higher the organism, the greater the influence you can exert, up to human beings who are free. And free doesn't mean free to defy gravity. It doesn't mean free to reproduce without assistance. It doesn't mean free to fly unaided. But everything that is subject to human choice is subject to free choice. And the professor who insists that free will is an illusion and that all human behavior is determined, I have bad news for him. Someday his daughter is going to come home having eloped with a drug-addicted poet. And he will be aghast at that, but there's nothing he can do about it because his daughter's will is free. And sad for her, and God help her, she gets her marriage annulled and pulls her life together, but that's all subject to her free choice, and you can't control it. You can try to influence it. You can talk to her. You can try to persuade her. You can become a criminal and lock her up in the basement. There are all kinds of things that you can choose to do that may not be morally appropriate, but nevertheless, she's in control of her mind. She is 100% in control of her mind. She is always in control of her mind. The only way that you can cause her not to be in free, conceptually conscious, volitional control of her own mind is to go after her skull with a baseball bat. And if you hit her hard enough, that you destroy her mental functioning without actually killing her, now you've turned her into something like an animal. But as long as she is conceptually conscious, as long as she is in control of her mental faculties, then she's free. Her will is free, and there's nothing you can do about it. And practically speaking, there's nothing that you should do about it, because that's the way we're made. We're perfect the way we are. That's the way we're made. I think that one of the reasons that people are so adamant about this point of view, this idea that human behavior is determined and that free will is an illusion, etc., and especially leaning on the Newtonian idea of physics, but you don't, frankly, you don't have to depend on Newtonian physics. You can also deploy quantum mechanics and say that human behavior is not determined by the watchword mechanism of the universe, that instead human behavior is essentially random, which is just exactly the same argument expressed a different way. The point here is to remove volition from the equation. And I think that many people associated with the academy, with university life, with formal systems in general, I think that many of those people make this argument as a means of expressing their atheism or really expressing their anti-theism. Free will obviously has a long, long history in religion, and it's obviously completely necessary for religion, because what the hell are you going to pass the offering plate for if whether or not somebody's going to put the money in is dependent upon the origin of the universe and not on their free choice. If everything is fated, there's no reason to pass the offering plate, because people are either going to give or not give, and they're all just automatons, they're robots, and they can't control it either way. But free will is a big part of religion, and obviously the idea of sin is based on free will, the idea of regret, remorse, but also ideas of virtue like pride. All of these things are based on free will, and I think a lot of people who make these anti-free will arguments are doing it because they are hostile to religion. And just lately, last 10 years or so, really since 9/11, anti-theism has become a big business. So Christopher Hitchens, before he died, and Richard Dawkins, and Daniel Dennett, I think his name is, and Sam Harris, who I've been picking on lately, and some other people have made a big business out of preaching against religion, which is a brave and courageous philosophical stand that they all took only 75 years too late. It's completely ridiculous in the modern era to criticize religion. Religion is a dead letter. Friedrich Nietzsche said God is dead, and what he meant by that is not that there had been an omnipotent universe creator who has since expired. What he meant was religion is no longer a potent argument in the marketplace of moral philosophy, and this is true for people who are putatively theologians also. We don't say, don't do that because you'll go to hell, do this because you'll go to heaven. We don't make those arguments. We say, don't do that because it will destroy your family. Don't do that because it will be harmful to your body. Don't do that because it will result in enduring misery in your life. We use psychology, economics, there are all kinds of arguments that we use to counsel people about their behavior, about their moral philosophy, but very rarely, I mean, only extremely religious people are going to be making references to heaven and hell, because God is dead. That's why, because God is dead. And so, you know, making a brave stand against religion in 2006 or 2010, I'm not impressed. I mean, it's just more public assholery, if you ask me. It's just being an asshole in public and trying to pick a fight with someone who doesn't intend to fight back, and, you know, being the bravest bully on an uninhabited island. But the other end of this is there are a whole lot of people who want to buy in to the argument that free will is an illusion, that all human behavior is determined, is fated, is unavoidable, because they don't want to take responsibility for their moral life. They don't want to take responsibility for behaving better. They don't want to take they don't want to bear the consequences of their own past bad behavior. And so, for instance, I've been talking a lot lately at freetheanimal.com, which is a weblog run by my friend Richard Nicolai, and it's devoted to paleo living in general, but a lot of it is about diet and exercise. And if you start talking about diet and exercise, this doesn't come up at Richard's blog, but it does come up all the time. As soon as you start talking about diet and exercise, you'll get people who will step up and say, oh, no, obesity is not a choice. And that's true. Obesity is not a choice. It's overeating that is a choice. It's not exercising that is a choice. Obesity is just the consequence. Oh, but no, I've tried it. I've tried eating less. I've tried exercising, and it doesn't work. Well, that's false. That is completely false. It's obviously false. It doesn't happen quickly. It's not easy. You're certainly not going to get the results you're expecting, because we're human beings and we always expect more results for our efforts than we get, especially right away. But if you want to insist that eating less will not cause you to lose weight, then you need to go visit the idyllic island nation of Cuba, run by the last refuge of red communists in the Western Hemisphere, where if you are not closely connected with the Communist Party, you are skinny. Every ordinary person in Cuba is skinny, and the reason for that is because they don't have enough food. If they had the bounteous abundance that Americans are used to having, the Cubans might all be as corpulent as Americans are, but in fact, they're starving in Cuba. Not necessarily starving, but they're getting by on very little food, and in consequence, they're all very svelte. They're all very skinny, and they probably exert themselves a whole lot more, too, because motorized transportation may be quite a bit more expensive for them than it is for us, and so they probably walk more than we do, maybe run more than we do, maybe carry more than we do. But the real difference between the skinny Cubans and the fat Americans is the skinny Cubans eat a lot less. And that is the difference. I mean, this actually you could do as a completely useless scientific study would be comparing descendants of Cuban refugees in South Florida with Cubans in Cuba, and just comparing them by height and weight. And in South Florida, I predict that the descendants of the Cuban migration will be taller and fatter than the Cubans living in Cuba. They'll be taller because they drink more milk, and they'll be fatter because they eat more and exercise less. And we can do the same thing, actually, comparing Norwegians in Minnesota with Norwegians in Norway. There's all kinds of comparisons we could make like that, but we don't want to make those things, because as soon as we make those comparisons, we have to recognize that the human will is free, and that our behavior is not determined, it is not fated, it is not baked in a cake from the birth of the universe, and it's not fated by our blood chemistry or by our hormones or by our economic circumstances or by our parentage or by any of the stupid claims that academics will make about determined human behavior. None of those things is true. Our behavior obviously is influenced by a whole host of biological factors, and I don't dispute that. But in the end, when you are at an inflection point, when you are at the point where you are deciding whether or not to have another piece of chocolate cake, your choice is free. You have the opportunity to choose. And, you know, you may be goaded by real bodily hunger, and you may be goaded by some kind of emotional hunger, and you may be salivating like a Pavlov's dog, and there may be all kinds of biological factors in play at the point that you're making that decision. But nevertheless, it is never impossible for you to say, you know what, I am sick to death of being this fat. I am sick to death of being tired all the time. I'm going to put that piece of cake back in the refrigerator, and I'll have it tomorrow instead. That choice is free. That choice is yours. That's the way the universe really works. And I told you at the outset that I would come back to the idea of religion. I've touched on it briefly with the idea of not just atheism, but anti-theism, which I think is, atheism I think is completely appropriate. I don't believe there is a God, at least not a God as described in religious apocrypha. And, you know, because I don't believe this, it's easy for me to compare one holy book to another. And as soon as you do that, as soon as you look at the other guy's holy book, that if you're a Christian, if you go look at the Quran or you look at the Bhagavad Gita or some other religion's holy book, you will see immediately that these arguments are completely ridiculous. And by inference, I mean, you look at two, you look at three, you look at five, and eventually you start to note a pattern that they're all ridiculous. And then at that point, you might go back to the Bible or to the Quran if you're Muslim, or your own holy book. At that point, you might go back and say, you know what? This book is ridiculous, too. These claims cannot possibly be true. And I don't care if you do or don't. My wife believes in God. She's not religious in the sense that she's, you know, bound to some church or some explicit, ludicrous, apocryphal doctrine. But she believes in God, and she prays like 30 prayers a day or something like that. And I don't have any problem with this, whatever. I think she's a wonderful woman. I really like her. And the reason that I really like her is because I like the way she behaves. That her reasons for behaving the way she does are hers, and I can't control them, I can't replace them, and I wouldn't want to. It would be ridiculous. I certainly wouldn't want anybody trying to do that with me. But whatever it is, whatever beliefs of hers guide her actions are perfect. They're wonderful, in my opinion. I love the way she behaves. I think she behaves better than I do. And I make a very stout effort. I mean, it's very important to me to behave wisely and well, to behave appropriately, to do exactly the right thing. And yet I think her behavior is better than mine. I think she is a nicer person than me, a better person than me. She has a better character than mine. And if the reason for that is her belief in God, then more power to her imaginary God. I think it's imaginary. I don't think it's real, but it's hers. She can have it. And I don't fight it. I don't dispute it. And I feel this way about everybody's religion. I don't care very much what you think, but I care a great deal about how you behave. And if your behavior is atrocious, which is what we associate with 9/11, for instance, the reason that all of these anti-theists decided to gang up on religion was, I guess, to gang up on Islam. But in that case, Islam is just a proxy for bad behavior. I'm not saying that I think Islam is a good religion. I don't think it is. I don't think any religion is good. But if we're going to rank religions on how they encourage or discourage bad behavior, I'm going to kind of side with the Buddhists before Islam is going to be well down on my list, and maybe the bottom of my list, certainly among religions that are currently being practiced by significant numbers of people. Islam tends to produce a whole lot of nuts. And so does Christianity, frankly. And this is one of the things, the Christians do this, the Christians do that. I agree. Just not in the same numbers. That Christians produce nuts, I agree. Christianity, not Christians. Christianity can produce some people who behave very, very badly, but their numbers are incredibly small compared to the numbers of people who behave atrociously, allegedly buttressed by the doctrines of Islam. But even so, it doesn't really matter, because it's not those doctrines that are the problem, and it certainly is not the incredible millions or billions of people, I guess it's about a billion people, who are advocates of Islam. It is the very small number of people who commit crimes and attempt to rationalize those crimes with their religion. And so the religion doesn't really matter to me all that much at all. What matters to me is the crime. And we started off talking about Marxists, and the Marxists killed 160 million people in the last century. And whatever crimes you want to attribute to Islamo-fascists, people who practice a criminal philosophy and attempt to justify it with Islam, whatever crimes you want to attribute to them, they are very small in number compared to 160 million political murders. That the most deadly religion on the earth is Marxism. And Marxism is a religion, and this kind of free will determinism, this human behavior is determined, this kind of Newtonianism, I would regard that as a religion also, because it's so defiantly contrary to plainly observable facts. It is at war with reason. And by reason, I mean acting appropriately to your circumstances, you know, taking account of the true nature of the universe, acting in ontological consonance with the universe, an ontologically consonant teleology. What a mouthful. I love those words. Ontologically consonant teleology. Say that 10 times fast. But in consequence, I don't have any huge objection to religion or to practitioners of religion as such. I only object to bad behavior, to criminal behavior. And so I guess I am maybe the world's most tolerant atheist. I am an atheist. I don't believe in the existence of any apocryphal kind of God. And at this point, it will be common for theologians to jump up and say, hey, but wait a minute, what if the universe is an artifact? What if the universe is a made thing? I am not prepared to argue that the universe is not a made thing. I don't know. And I think these are the most, absolutely the most valuable words that any human being can master. This is the essence of good philosophy. This is the essence of good science. This is the essence of reason, is to be able to stand up on your own two feet and stare a difficult question in the face and say, I don't know. I don't know why organisms resist entropy. I don't know why organisms exist in the first place. I don't know why organisms behave the way they do and why their behavior is so defiant of the ideas of Newtonian or quantum physics. I don't know why higher organisms are willful in their behavior, and I don't know why human beings have free will. I know that I am possessed of an idea that I call father tongue, which is a complex notation system, such as the one I'm using right now in speech, but also such as the one I'm using right now on my guitar. And frankly, the one that I'm using consequences of in the way, in this computer, in the computer in front of you, in this incredible network, all of this is father tongue, and I love it. I think it's wonderful. How do we have it? I have no idea. I don't know why this exists. And in the same respect, I certainly cannot prove to my satisfaction, or really to anyone else's satisfaction, that the universe is necessarily natural in origin, meaning it's not an artifact. It's not a made thing. It is plausible to me. I mean, I don't rate this plausibility very highly, but it is plausible to me that the whole thing is made by something else. It plausibly could be. Or, you know, that the universe itself is natural in origin, but organisms were made by something else, made by some species of life or whatever that is so far beyond us that we can't even conceive of it. And this is the idea of the singularity. The model breaks down. That's what a singularity literally means, is that you're at a point where the map that you're using to navigate is no longer useful. It no longer describes the territory that you're in. And it is plausible to me that the things that we're talking about could be artifacts in one way or another, that could be made things, that something could have made these things. And again, I don't rate this as a very high plausibility. To the contrary, I do believe in the natural origin of everything. But that's simply a belief, and I don't have any basis for proving it, and you don't have any basis for disproving it. And really simply to introduce the topic at all is kind of masturbatory, because it's useless. It does us no benefit, whatever. We don't learn anything from it. But this is the kind of thing that theologians love to elicit this admission. Richard Dawkins made it recently, a very similar admission. He couldn't prove that the universe is not created by something other than raw nature, pure nature. This is honesty. This is intellectual honesty. If you are an atheist and you insist that the universe can't be a made thing, then I think you're basically just arguing from a different religious point of view. You're making claims that you can't defend. And really, ultimately, that's what religion is, in the sense that religion is potentially damaging, teleologically damaging to your interest, to your future behavior, your future self-adoration. What religion is an attempt to make claims that you can't defend. Whereas to be intellectually honest is to acknowledge the universe for what it is and to behave appropriately, to respond accordingly. Wow. It's a lot of philosophy. I wanted to take up one practical topic today. And we've had participants come and go, but nobody has requested to talk to me, which is kind of unfortunate, because I really would like to talk to people and I really would like to take on questions. And I know sooner or later, if I do this enough, I know sooner or later people will join me, so I will. And obviously it's no problem at all for me to carry on at great length without any interaction, whatever. But today is Tuesday, June 5th, and it is the recall election in Wisconsin today. And I just think it's kind of interesting. Governor Scott Walker in Wisconsin was elected on a platform that he would try to rein in the public employee unions in Wisconsin, and he did that in a very minor way to the teachers' unions. And the teachers' unions immediately went on the warpath, because this is what unions do in general, and public employee unions, of course, are the most virulent virulently criminal kind of unions. A union is a criminal cartel. That's what it is. And, you know, people will always say, oh, well, I believe in unions. No, I don't believe in unions. And I come from a union family. If employers are behaving in a criminal fashion, that's bad. But the response to criminality is not more criminality. It's just a fallacy too. Okay, you do it too. Two wrongs make a right. When you proceed on that way, you end up with chaos. People call anarchy chaos, but anarchy is not chaos. What is chaos is unlimited pressure group warfare. And so if employers are behaving criminally, that's a bad thing and it needs to be addressed. But the proper redress is not more crime. It's less crime. It's eliminating the original crime. And to create this chain gang and to force people to belong to the chain gang, whether they want to or not, I think that's obscene. And to take that one step further and have public employees creating a chain gang that they then force all the taxpayers in the state to subsidize their criminality, and this is much, much worse. And so the mere existence of public employee unions is a crime. I mean, you want to say that a private union, especially a free union, in other words, that you can freely join, you can freely quit, you're not compelled to join, and the employer is not compelled to negotiate, not compelled to bargain with the union, I don't have a problem with that, because now we're talking about a club. It's no longer a union. A union implies coercion, and coercion is crime. But a public employee union is double the coercion, and therefore it's double the crime. And so the mere existence of public employee unions is offensive. But public employee unions attempting to hijack the state, which is what they're doing in this recall election, that's doubly absurd. It's triply absurd. It's completely obscene. And this recall election is very interesting because it's a real test of the mettle of the Tea Party movement, of the, you know, resistance to statism movement. And it will be interesting to see if we actually can do something. That Walker rolled back, in a minor way, not in a huge way, but rolled back some of the benefits that these teachers' unions were getting. And the question is, will the voters of Wisconsin support him in that? Will they continue him in office? And if they do, this will be the first real reversal. I mean, you've been hearing since Nixon anyway, you've been hearing the left squall and squeal and squirm and shout and rail that the Republicans were doing some kind of great violence to the welfare state. And none of that is true. None of it is true. That Republicans occasionally are capable of repealing taxes, but nobody has been able to stop the march of the welfare state since Roosevelt, but really since Abraham Lincoln, that we fought the Civil War to free slaves, and that's a noble sentiment, but what we did in consequence was we enslaved everyone else, and the level of slavery imposed by Lincoln was pretty small compared to the level of slavery imposed by Roosevelt, but that level of slavery is still very small compared to what we're living under now, and we are at, really, practically speaking, we are almost at the tipping point. We are almost at the point where the number of people stealing from the productive exceeds the number of productive. And it doesn't really matter. That doesn't matter so much as how they vote. But if the exploiters, if the moochers, if the looters become a majority in the polls, then the United States will perish. That liberal democracy, liberal government, Republican government will perish because we will become a kleptocracy. We will become, and it's not a kleptocracy like we usually associate, like a Latin American kleptocracy, where the El Presidente and his cadre of criminals are stealing everything and impoverishing everyone else. Instead, we will be a broad scale, widespread kleptocracy, where everybody will be attempting to steal $150 from everybody else. Which, I mean, is really tragically stupid that the one thing you could say for that kind of, you know, South American kleptocracy is at least somebody ends up a millionaire. But in the United States, we're all just squabbling over nothing. We're all squabbling over, you know, $150 at a time. But the challenge for people who oppose this idea is to reverse anything, to change anything, to cut anything. And so far, the Tea Party has been remarkably unsuccessful. I'm not criticizing them. It's a new idea, and I think it's, you know, to be commended. I hope these people succeed. But so far, they haven't succeeded, and today is really the test to whether or not they can succeed, to whether or not they can effect any change whatever. And if they can, if they can successfully reverse the direction of public employee unions in Wisconsin, then maybe they can achieve another victory somewhere else. And it'll also be a very small victory at first. But anything other than continued growth of the Leviathan state, any change at all is a welcome change. And frankly, the only way that we're ever going to get back to anything like a free society in the United States is by reversing our direction. And as the first step that you take after reversing your direction is necessarily going to be a very small step. But if we can successfully take that first step, then we can go for the second step and the third and the fourth and the fifth and the 500th and the 5,000th. And each one of those steps, presumably, plausibly, will be progressively larger. And obviously the benefits will start to pile up and the benefits will become undeniable. And again, academia is populated by Marxists. Academia, the media, the mainstream media, the press, the intellectual classes in general are overwhelmingly Marxist. And accordingly, they are going to lie about the consequences of these kind of changes, but eventually the benefits will become undeniable. And then when that happens, we can start to make real progress. But today is really the first really serious test of the Tea Party idea, and it'll be interesting to see how it turns out. So I'm definitely excited about this, and I don't normally care about electoral politics in any way at all. Most politicians are rent seekers, libertarian socialists, and I don't doubt that this is also true of Scott Walker and the politicians who supported him and the politicians who are campaigning for him today. I don't doubt that they're all rent seekers. I don't doubt that they're all criminals. And yet, here is an opportunity to really reverse the tide of tyranny, and it will be interesting to see how it works out. So, I made it. I have way more that I could talk about, but I'll let it go for today. I will make this video available by embed at selffederation.com. And if you go to Spreecast and look for Man Alive, just search for Man Alive and you will find my video channel so that if you want to, you can embed this video. I'll do this again tomorrow and see if we can get somebody to show up and talk. And in the meantime, I am really grateful to you for attending to what I had to say, for listening to me. I will make an effort to be even more interesting tomorrow. Bless you. Thank you so much. You have yourself a wonderful day. Have a great day today and every day.